Hi, I'm Sophia Rowe, chef and wellness enthusiast. Did you know that nearly 340,000, or one in five, New York City children rely on soup kitchens and food pantries to eat, especially during the summer months when school is out? The folks over at Food Bank for New York City want you to know that unlike school, hunger doesn't take a break. Help them end child hunger by providing meals to families and children in need during those challenging summer months. Visit foodbanknyc.org to learn how you can volunteer, spread the word, and more. Boys and girls are on fire. Boys and girls are on fire. Whole world's shaking, breaking, baby, and we're on fire.
Hi, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we talk to the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. Let's thank today's sponsors, Le Cordon Bleu Culinary Schools and Traeger Wood-Fired Grills. I hope everyone has had a great summer. I am in total shock, though, that fall is right around the corner. In all honesty, I didn't have that much of a summer because I had to deal with everything around the closing and the sale of my coffee shop, Smith Canteen, RIP Smith Canteen. But I can't really complain because I was in Ireland last week and I had a really epic time. I was on a Kerrygold press trip and it was pretty life-changing. I'll be posting the highlights on the Cherry Bomb Instagram and on my own Insta at Kerrybomb, so be sure to check it out. Lots of scones, butter, cows, grass, just wait. What else is going on? I'll be back on the road for the Radio Cherry Bomb Food for Thought Tour. We are coming to, are you ready? Asheville, North Carolina, Columbus, Ohio, Kansas City, Missouri, Houston, Philadelphia, and Miami to record live episodes and to hang with the Bomb Squad in each city. Tickets are on sale right now at cherrybomb.com. Thanks to our friends at Kerrygold for sponsoring our tour. Since I've been spending so much time with the Kerrygold folks, I keep trying to talk them into giving me my own signature butter. You would too, wouldn't you? I have the whole thing planned out. It would be called Kerrygold, Carrie Diamond. Very original. Jess, did I tell you this? Jess is our producer. Jess has no idea what I'm talking about. So Kerrygold, Carrie Diamond would have sparkling Irish sea salt incorporated throughout the whole stick, or maybe on top. And the packaging could be sky blue, my favorite color, better than black, my other favorite color. Black butter packaging probably doesn't go over that well in supermarkets. But you can see it, right? I haven't succeeded just yet in convincing the executives, but stay tuned. All right, and all of you know, or at least I hope you do, we are doing a Jubilee conference in Seattle. I am so in love with that city, as you can probably tell from the Cherry Bomb Instagram, because we've been Instagramming a lot of Seattle content. So many cool people, so much great food. Chef Renee Erickson's places, Chef Rachel Yang's restaurants, London Plain, Rachel's ginger beer, Frankie and Joe's plant-based ice cream, Kamonegi for homemade buckwheat noodles and other deliciousness. Early bird tickets for Jubilee Seattle are on sale at cherrybomb.com right now. So again, don't miss out. Because I've been traveling so much, we have a special guest host this week, my friend Jordana Rothman. She is the restaurant editor at large for Food and Wine magazine and an all-around awesome human being. Jordana talks with Elena Reagan, the talented and wildly creative chef behind Elizabeth Restaurant in Chicago and the brand new Milkweed Inn in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Also, Elena somehow found the time to write a memoir called Burn the Place, which is out right now. If Elena's name sounds familiar, maybe it's because she is in the Cherry Bomb Cookbook, she's on the Cherry Bomb 100, and we covered her wedding in issue 12 of Cherry Bomb magazine, the one with Sophia Rowe on the cover. Clearly, we love Elena Reagan. Stay tuned for Elena and Jordana's very honest conversation about Elena's food journey, the power of memory, and how she came into her queer identity. Before we get to their conversation, let's hear a word from our friends at Le Cordon Bleu. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and patisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin.
I got this book on Monday. I had read an excerpt from it. I was sort of thought that I was going to have to rush to get it all in, and then I just like completely jammed through it because it's so exquisitely written, and it surprised me 0% to read that you had studied writing and that that was one of your great passions in life before you decided to cook, I guess. And I just, what strikes me the most, and particularly actually in the beginning, which I think makes a lot of sense, because in the beginning you are a child and you are remembering what it felt like to be a kid, which is a sort of wild exercise in general to really put yourself in that place. And you write in this way that is incredibly vivid and in sort of nonlinear bursts. And it sort of reminded me of like trying to tell someone a dream before you forget it, or just like recounting a memory that there are pieces missing from. And it felt very, very human. And I just wonder, how did you put yourself in that frame of mind to sort of get into the sort of like richness of memory? Like, did you have to go through a process to remember these things?
I didn't have to go through a process. I think that I recall those memories frequently throughout all of my life and throughout my adulthood. Like, I could have probably written just a whole book of memories from childhood, you know, like, and not moved past anything beyond the age of 10 or beyond the age of leaving that farmhouse. So I didn't have to really do much mentally to prepare. The way I wrote the memories or the memoir piece of that was how I would probably tell it, and exactly how I remember the actual visions of it. So as I moved on through the book, being, you know, having studied a little bit of writing, probably when you get to the middle section, you know, when we talk about being, you know, my drug addiction and everything else, it might get a little bit more vulgar, but that's who I was at the time. And then at the end, it probably wraps up a little bit more with less profanity, which is a little bit now how I am as an adult. I mean, unless I haven't had coffee, then, you know, it would be a different interview. I would be cussing a lot more because that's how I feel when I don't have coffee. But I've been caffeinated this morning, so I'm fine.
I thought a lot about the role of food. Obviously, it's a food memoir, but one of the things that really struck me is the sort of shifting nature of what food represents to you and to the various people who are important to you as you tell it in your life. And I feel like there's a incredibly vivid and sort of astonishing and disturbing story early in the book about, you know, this sort of formative moment with your father and your uncle at your grandfather's farm looking for chanterelles, which are on the cover of your book. And then you're lifted up by a tornado and, you know, sort of edge very close to a potential trauma that you, you know, don't articulate too much, but it feels like something quite dark might have happened were you not rescued at that last moment by another family member. And then at the sort of end of that moment, you talk about the cooking of the chanterelles and with butter and with your father and this incredibly tender moment of him sharing how you would prepare them. And so in that moment, it feels like food is restoration and recovery and sort of grounding in nature, comfort and almost coddling in some ways. And then, you know, later in the really wonderful chapter about your mother, Jenny's, where she's making pierogies, food becomes a sort of battleground and this like pride and this sort of, you know, withholding or giving as a gesture. And it is really incredible to see how it is such a powerful vessel and sort of follows you narratively through the book. And I wonder, as an adult now and with, is it 9 years sobriety?
Yeah, 9 and a half.
9 and a half. Congratulations. Obviously, a ton of clarity. You're married. You're a business owner. What role does, or what sort of metaphorically does food represent to you now?
Oh, I think that it, well, I would think that it still goes to that same place of comfort. And I think that, you know, just like alcoholism can be a family disease and an inherited trait, whereas, you know, you might not always have the affliction of the actual addiction to the alcohol, but some of those isms that people talk about can really get passed down. You know, it's not in the book, but every single serious partner I have ever had, every single one, and this is not an exaggeration, their father has died of alcoholism. You know, so it's like there's no coincidence that we all find each other somewhere and that, like, somehow this thing becomes really a part of genetics and family behavior and learned behavior. And so I think I was with my mom so much as a child. And for her, as I describe in the book, that food was the expression of love. Like, that was the way that she absolutely felt love as a child. And so I think that that's where it still stands with me today. But you're right, there is some battleground to it. And if I think about it, you know, my mom ended up hating the garden and the things that my dad, you know, he did the growing and she did the canning. And, you know, for her, that was kind of a job. She's like, you know, it wasn't her passion. Like, she does love cooking food, but I don't think, like, she wanted necessarily all of that in that way. And so I'm just thinking, like, out loud, but I guess it is kind of a battleground, because as much as I love food and cooking and preparing and sharing that experience with others and really expressing myself through it, because I do find it to be an equally creative outlet as I do writing, I think that running a restaurant, though, is like, you don't just, as the chef and the owner and the business person of it, I don't just get to create the beautiful dishes. I create them, and then I have to teach the staff, and then I have to reteach the staff when they do it wrong, and then we have to serve it to people, and I have to hope that they seasoned it right, and then I have to do payroll and pay the sales taxes. And because I do all those components, because we're so small, like, I can't hire a management team and an HR department, you know. That is like my internal battle, you know, because I have to have this restaurant that I want to maintain and that I love, but at the same time, there's so many things that are so just really, like, atrocious that I hate. And so that, I mean, that's actually a good segue to lead into Burn the Place and the prologue of the book, where seriously, I'm like, I want to Molotov cocktail this fucking place down, yeah. You know? But I can't, because I think that now it would be really obvious who did it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that's out.
Yeah, that's out. You know, as I've been thinking out loud, talking through some of these interviews with others too, is that, you know, I'm discovering that Burn the Place also is, you know, also maybe a metaphor too for just where I'm at in life and, you know, figuring out what I want to do next, because, like, I'm almost 40 and I don't want to have this restaurant when I'm 55. Like, as I get older, all the employees stay the same age, you know, anywhere between 22 to 26. Sometimes I'm lucky and I get somebody over 30, and either they are just a really hard worker and understand the business, and so they're really great to work with, or, you know, they already know everything, and then it's also really hard to work with. So I don't want to be 55 and dealing with 20-year-olds that, like, are, you know, not my own. Like, I would like to have my own family, and maybe when I'm 55, I have to be dealing with 15-year-olds, but I just don't want it.
You've begun the process of finding something else for yourself. It sounds like you have an inn in the Upper Peninsula in Michigan called the Milkweed Inn, which you know, I mean, the photos look amazing. And I was, you know, in your, I think it's in your epilogue where you're talking about the silver bullet with Anna. And it looks like you've made that into one of the rooms at the inn, which is so beautiful. There are a few things I want to talk about. And in particular, I guess we'll pivot into the woods because it sounds like that's where you're headed now, which is only natural for you because that's where you started. It strikes me like sort of towards the end of the book where you're talking about going back to your grandfather's land with your father. And there's this fear that really lives there for you and your father, but also you're compelled towards it, even though it scares you. You have to sort of go deeper into the woods to find mushrooms, and your father sort of standing on the edge of the woods and calling you back. You mentioned that you wondered at one point if he might have been a victim. And it strikes me that the ways in which you sort of learn to work with the land to harvest mushrooms and to can and preserve and gather in some ways is sort of controlling that fear, right? Like maybe learning to make the land work for you is sort of getting in front of the fear that very much exists there. And it's sort of getting to a comfortable place of understanding that you have to live in lockstep with that fear. You can't be bested by it and you can't sort of kill it. So you have to make it work. Does that resonate at all?
I hadn't thought of that, but now I'm like, oh, maybe this is like a really interesting therapy session because, you know, at the cabin now, it's completely wilderness. It's not like that farm where my grandfather had. About a week ago, I went out to go foraging, and I had to go about, like, so we're buried about, like, 8 miles down a dirt road in the middle of, like, some small mountains and just thick, thick trees. There's nothing around, and for, like, miles and miles. And then we're at least 30 miles from any service. So I had to go to pick some things because along our trails, as we're driving in and out, I watch very closely of what is there. And so I knew that some berries were getting ripe. So I drove about 20 feet and I saw a black bear. It was probably like 6 feet tall and probably 400 pounds. And this is, I'm under-exaggerating because I don't want to like over-exaggerate. And okay. I think it was way
the right
bigger.
Amount of exaggerating. Yeah.
It was like, so, I don't know. It was so huge that all I said was, holy shit. And it was running across the road from one part of the woods to the other. It was so black that it was almost silver or blue, and it had the little bit of the brown nose, and it was just incredible. Like, it was like breathtaking and a little bit heart-stopping at the same time, because I had never seen an animal that huge in the wild before. And so now the evening comes, and Anna and I are outside, and the dogs are in the yard, and it's about 9 p.m., and we hear a huge growling or roaring not that far away and a lot of thrashing through the brush. And so it sounded like the bears were maybe fighting or playing, and so we got the dogs in the house, and we went inside. And where we're at, because it's so wild, they're not used to being fed by humans, and so they're really not that dangerous because they're going to run before they, like, that's probably why that one was running, because he heard my truck coming. So they're not that much of a threat, but there is still a fear. And so this last time I was there, Anna won't let me go foraging now. She's almost like the version of my dad, where I was going to a piece of land where I knew that there was lots of dewberries and strawberries, and I was like, I gotta go pick them. So she took the shotgun that her dad gave her, her stepdad, and had the bullets in her pocket. She has no idea how to fire it. and is like, I'm going to go with you. And so, like, I was picking berries, and she's standing there with a shotgun, like, in case a bear comes, like, one, like, she'll actually hit it, and two, like, that it might actually die, because that's probably not going to stop a bear if it's as big as the one I saw. So, but then the next time when I went out by myself, I was going to look for mushrooms through the area where we have a lot of pine, and I put on this full mosquito outfit, and I took the bear mace with me because she kept saying, take a gun, take a gun. And like, we're not gun people and we don't like guns, but the thing is like, kind of when you're in the wilderness, everybody that we've met up there is like, well, if you're going out foraging, you should take a gun with you. And I was like, okay, so I got this bear mace in my, like, little pouch where I keep all my stuff that I put the foraging things. But I was going down by the river, which we suspect they probably hang out a lot to go catch fish and eat and things like that. So I felt like I was actually constantly looking over my shoulder, but this time it's not for, like, bad humans. Mm-hmm. It's, like, for, like, real wild animals.
A point that I would feel really remiss if we didn't get to talk about, actually, is the queerness of this book, if you're mm-hmm. comfortable talking about it.
I wrote, like, everything I could probably think about
as far
as that goes in there.
This is just, it's the gayest food memoir available at the moment, so I highly recommend those of you looking for queer stories and food, get it. I want to talk about gender with you because it's a topic that just keeps coming up in this book and in many ways feels like something that you're sort of working out as you are writing it. It's such a character in the book, gender and your sort of tussles with it and exploration of it. You talk a lot about sort of in the first chapter of the book, finding out that you weren't a boy. And it feels like in some ways the times when you were reminded of your femaleness were moments in which the power was sort of taken from you. And I wonder, too, as you sort of, and I think you do get here in the course of the book, whether that sort of questioning of gender is about that you are questioning, you know, sort of, or wishing that you might have been a boy, or if it's the sort of the childlike understanding that you were born gay and you're a gay woman, and before you sort of understood what was available to you, you sort of had this understanding that, okay, like, I want to be with women, and a person who is with women is a boy.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, because when I think, at least that's how I think as an adult, what was going on for me as a child.
Right, a sort of heteronormative.
Yeah, because it's raising. Weird too, because like when I realized some of those things from, I mean, like, I think before I could even talk, I mean, my mom said I would scream bloody murder if they tried to put me in a dress, you know? So from a very early age, and at that point, it's not that you know, like, oh, I want to be with a woman, you know, like, so, but then as I was maybe like 3 and 4 and 5, and I can realize now, like, okay, that was definitely where my head was with it. Like, I must be a boy because I like girls. Without that obviously being sexual in any way, but seeing, like you said, like the heteronormative relationships. And yes, like then, you know, I didn't hear about gay people or know what they were or know that that was an option, you know, and when I finally did kind of have little clues into it, then if it was a gay man, usually like, well, I don't know what if Boy George is gay. Is that crazy that I'm like, I don't know if Boy George is gay? Is everybody like, oh, he's gay?
Gay.
Is he gay? Okay.
It's sort of like, you know, when you say a word out loud for the first time that you've only ever read and you realize you don't know how to pronounce it. Well, actually, but that moment is so cool in the book, actually, because that for me, that was my absolute favorite, most poignant moment when you're leaving the farmhouse and you are leaving the boy mm-hmm. behind. And then there is this instantaneous pivot into an admiration of people who occupied this middle space. So Boy George, Annie Lennox, and it feels so right that you sort of get to this place where you're like, it's not this binary thing. There are people who occupy this space, and maybe there's something in that for you.
You know, as a kid watching that, I was like, oh my God, what is that? You know, and just being absolutely enthralled. But yeah, even, I mean, I know as the book goes on, I'm still kind of like was working it out. And honestly, I think that as a child, though, if I was a kid now and that same exact kid, I think I, you know, and with knowing, you know, it's so much more widely talked about in TV and news and everywhere that I think people even living in rural areas still have much more of an understanding of what gay and lesbian and queer and trans and all those things are, that I probably would have been asking my parents to change my gender. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, it's really hard to say, because now, you know, as an adult, I know, like, I don't want to be male, like why would I want to be one of them? But it doesn't still mean that on the inside I don't feel a duality, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's interesting, because like Anna and I have these conversations a lot about queerness and gender and trans and all these things, because it's so fascinating and there's so many things to discuss. But when I meet men, like when women sometimes meet other women, they feel a natural competition. Mm-hmm. I don't feel that with women. But when I meet men, I feel it with them immediately. And I know that other men sometimes feel that with men. And I don't think it's that normal that women feel competition with men. Or maybe they do when they're in industries like I am, but I've felt that my whole life. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if that's a testament to my gender or like who I am on the inside, and if that puts me in that middle space of they, them, or just kind of like I am not either, or if that's a learned behavior from my dad, who was clearly pretty sexist and, you know, obviously still says sexist things like, I can't hear women's voices, you know, like, oh my God. You know, like, no matter what, I love him, but he's, you know, he's still that dude that is like, oh my God. And growing up in that environment, and also now currently in this work environment that is male dominated, where it's like, yeah, I feel like I have to work harder as a woman and harder to get recognition and, you know, like a lot of things. You know, like I even think I wrote in the book, like if I looked like Brad Pitt in Fight Club, like I would be like so much more famous. Like that book would probably be on the bestseller list right now if it was the same exact freaking story.
Let's talk about restaurants for a moment. Kitsune. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's so complicated, because it has struggled since day one. Like, we were undercapitalized when we started it. And this is just, like, the honest truth. And for the first month, I was there all the time, but then I had to go back and open Elizabeth. And I kind of took my A team to Kitsune, B team to Elizabeth, and things were just being mismanaged, from like food costs to too many employees on, et cetera, et cetera. And that has to be my fault, because I'm ultimately in charge of that. But it just, like, if I wasn't at one restaurant, one fell apart and then the other one would fall apart, if, you know, just depending on where I situated myself. And ultimately, Elizabeth is the helm. You know, that's the one that makes everything else breathe. And I was like, guys, if I lose this restaurant, then everything goes, you know, so I have to focus there. And we just could, I eventually found a really great team there, because obviously it turned over a little bit in the beginning, and a great team that stuck. But by the time they stuck, it was already like the newness wore off and people stopped coming as much. And so it slowly got slower as things got better and better. You know, this is such a typical, I feel like, Chicago restaurant story. It probably happens a lot in New York, too. And even with all the great accolades, like Esquire and GQ and all the, you know, local critics and stuff like that, it just dies down, you know, because new things open and people get excited and you lose focus and they get distracted. And so you know, it just became one of those things where, like, I tried everything from, like, little special, like, omakase dinners that I did, or little themed dinners, or, you know, creating ramen kits that we sold, or just whatever it was that I could think of that fit within our brand. But then those are only become, like, short-term,
right?
You know, like, little Band-Aids. Right. And we just never caught up from the beginning, and Elizabeth had loaned, you know, Kitsune like $82,000.
Wow.
That, like, you know, so it became a part, like, oh my God, like, I can't pay this back now, and one thing after another. So it just becomes one of those things where it's like, okay, when are we finally going to pull the plug? And I kept keeping it open for the two guys who worked there, who were really, really great. My manager, who I taught to be my GM, and my chef de cuisine. I guess I waited until they had talked about it enough and brought it to me to mm-hmm. say, like, I think we need to close. And then I was like, you're right. We absolutely do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, that was actually something I was discussing a lot in therapy, was like, I have to close this restaurant and I do not know how to do it because I do not know how to approach these guys about it. And so we were talking a lot about boundaries, because it's like, why can't you just do it? Like, why can't you just go to these people and say, this is not working, and we have to close it? Like, I'm the boss, I'm the owner. You know, and for a while I was worried about the investors and feeling bad. And for most of them, it's like a good write-off for them for their taxes, you know, the loss. Still, I was just struggling with it. And it wasn't about, like, ego and having to stay open, because I, like, really don't give a shit. I am so freaking happy that
yeah.
it is closed, because even though I wasn't there every single day and I had those guys in charge, both of them I've made space for at Elizabeth, and I think they're extremely happy that they're going to somewhere that is not constantly feeling like it's in failure mode.
Yeah.
And I had Tim, my guy who was the GM, I had taught him how to do the bookkeeping and watch, you know, the bank account and all those things. So he was doing that same, like, juggle struggle game that I generally oversee, but I was watching it happen as it would go yeah. down. The day he sent me a text message that said, hey, chef, can we talk when you're back in town? Because I was already up at Milkweed. I was like, yes. You know, because yeah. I knew it was going to be about that. Because if he saw the bank account that morning, which I had already saw, I was like,
yeah.
like, I don't know where the next dollar is coming from. Like, I don't know how we're going to do this, you know?
Yeah.
And I am out of, like, ideas, because a lot of the things I do at Elizabeth I love, but, like, I teach an 8-week cooking course, and most the time in the past, that cooking course, like, as soon as I got the money from it, I would give it to Kitsune.
Right.
You know? And, like, I was stretching myself thin to the point where it's not good for any of the businesses either.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still teaching the cooking course because I love to do it. But as an example, like, I would just take on all these extra projects to try to keep fueling that one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was getting to the point where, like, you know, it's just like, Anna's like, oh my God, you're going to go insane, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, you can see when you get to the point where, you know, you're feeding one to keep the other alive, and you get to a point where you both could be threatened because of that. And I think it's really important to, you know, reframe the idea of, like, success and failure in restaurants. Like, it's like our business is not comparable to other businesses in many ways. And so the idea of something failing is really, like, sticky, you know? And I think that clearly there are a lot of, like, emotional and business lessons to be had for you that you're articulating now. I mean, you trained these two people who are going to, like, have a meaningfully positive effect on the flagship restaurant. And you were talking earlier about sort of, like, the biggest struggle being managing people and teaching. And I think, you know, I always think about that when, like, historic restaurant closes, or, like, a restaurant that's been open for 10 years or something. I mean, that's historic is maybe a stretch there, but important to its community, you know, had longevity, and the idea of something failing after a decade of, like, feeding a community is just sort of absurd. And I think that it's important to, and obviously this is very new for you, but I think in time, Kitsune closing, I mean, but I think in time, sort of extracting the wins from that experience will be a meaningful
yeah.
exercise.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, you talk about process so much in the book. There's the whole, the Yes Chef chapter, which is so much about sort of like, once you sort of click into place, you're a chef, like this is who you are. Teaching that is really hard. Like, you talk about the sort of R&D behind getting like a donut right, and you articulate so much like what goes into making something not just good but consistent, something that can be replicated. And the same can be said of the experience of being a business owner. And it sounds like, I don't know, maybe that'll be your next book. I don't know.
The chapters about, you know, my current life and mostly about the career, as I realized even as you were talking about the Yes Chef chapter, like my mind started to drift a little bit. Not that you're not a great speaker or interesting, but I'm like, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Like, I would tell my editor, like, I cannot write this. And he's like, well, you have to put something about your career in there.
What you're describing is so, it is much easier to look back on a journey and be like, okay, like, here are the lessons that I learned, and here's like the bow to put on it, and here's everything, because that's behind you. And it's deeply confronting to write about who you are as a person now, because you're not even 40. Like, you're still writing it. You're still living it. And so the idea of like capturing an amber is like disturbing. I mean, it's like, cause, and so much has changed from the time of writing too.
Right. Yeah. And even, so I, in that chapter, I just try to like best convey what like the day of in the life feels like. And maybe to take some of the shine off of what people think is glamorous, because like I really don't think that this job is full of glitz and glamour. Like, when I meet people and they say, oh, what do you do? Like, when I met Anna's family for the first time, they were like, oh, and I hear you're a chef. What do you do? And I was like, yeah, I cook at a restaurant. Like, because I didn't want to, you know, like, I didn't want questions. I didn't want to talk about it. Like, I didn't even want to say it was my own restaurant. Like, I'd rather just say, like, yeah, I'm a line cook at IHOP. Like, you've been there, right?
I mean, I feel like I do that all the time when I'm traveling on the road, because when people find out that I'm a food writer, their first question is frequently, like, do you know Guy Fieri or something like that? And I just, like, you know, I can't manage it. But then sometimes I will say, you know, what I do. And then I get, you know, occasionally, like, incredibly tender things in return, and that's like that's the dice roll, is that sometimes people will be like, oh, I want you to know about this, you know, this restaurant or this recipe that my mom used to make, and it's like incredibly sweet, I'm so glad we had the conversation. But more frequently it's like, yeah, it's like people asking me about, you know, Guy Fieri. I don't know why. I don't know Guy Fieri. We're not buds. I'm sure he's a lovely man, not really my lane. Well, I want to ask you, like, I didn't know how our conversation was going to be, because I know that you just are really clear that you hate talking. And so I was like, is she gonna want to talk to me? But like, I don't know, I feel like we might get along, I don't know. But I guess a question that I always have for people who don't like talking about themselves is like, what do you wish people were asking you?
Probably nothing. Like, yeah, I mean, that's a weird thing, because it's like, well, you wrote a book and you have this, like, you know, restaurant that people are interested in, and like, of course you're going to have to talk about these things, and how can you so honestly express everything through food and through, you know, actually writing about yourself? And, you know, that's like, that's the really weird thing, is like, because I am such an introvert, and like, I guess it just depends on what the context is in the situation about like the talking. You know, my job has become more than a chef, is a problem solver, which is interesting and it's fun, but the part that I don't like is people needing me to come solve the problems for them when it's something that they can easily solve themselves, or that I give them the actual authority and autonomy to do.
And I guess I'll end by ending where you end in the book, which is this really sort of beautiful meditation, really emotional, beautiful moment of you and Anna in the wilderness, just sort of moving around in your silver bullet and finding places to lay your heads. And you talk about not being afraid anymore because you have this person and you have this and the confidence and the steadiness that she brings. It's an interesting place to end, particularly right now, I think, in America, because you're sort of like a road trip moment that you're talking about and sort of feeling safe places where you might not have expected to feel safe as a queer woman with her wife, you know, out in the wild. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I'll be frank and say that in many ways I feel more afraid than I've ever felt. I feel afraid. And I, to the extent that, you know, my partner and I have talked about, like, well, we actually need to have a sort of exit plan if things sort of cross a certain threshold in this country. Where do we go? Like, what do we do? And at what point do we do it? You know, because I come from, my ancestors did flee, and, you know, and that's why I'm alive, you know? And so I think about that, and I wonder, if you were writing it today, do you still feel the same safety?
Well, I mean, that last scene with, you know, that was actually last summer. Hmm. But the thing is Milkweed is my exit plan. Mm. It's in the Upper Peninsula, and we're 30 miles from Lake Superior. And when you cross Lake Superior at that point, you're in Canada. Mm-hmm. So there you have
That's
it.
Brilliant. our exit plan is Canada as well, so we'll see you there.
Yeah, we'll come to Milkweed Inn. It's completely off the grid. No, it's going to be the last place that people are going to be looking for a bunch of lesbos and queers. So what we'll do is just, we'll cross.
Thanks to Jordana and Elena. We'll be right back with a special speed round after this word from Traeger. Let me introduce you to Traeger Wood-Fired Grills, a company that has revolutionized cooking outdoors. I had the opportunity to see Traeger grills up close and in action at a special event we did this summer in the Hamptons. And let me tell you, they are beautiful pieces of equipment. Some of our favorite chefs proved just how versatile and easy Traeger grills are to use. We had grilled grapes. Yes, you can grill grapes and they are so tasty. They pair beautifully with burrata and grilled bread. We also had delicious grilled vegetables, beef tenderloin that was as soft as butter, and even a stone fruit galette. I had no idea you can make baked goods on a Traeger, but you can. Traeger grills infuse your food with wood-fired flavor. You can't say that about a charcoal or gas grill. Cook al fresco and do it hot and fast or low and slow, however you like. Try it on a Traeger. Visit TraegerGrills.com to learn more. Welcome back, everybody. We're slipping in a little speed round with one of the newest team members at Cherry Bomb, Miss Audrey Payne. Audrey was our intern earlier this year, and she is now a full-time staffer at Cherry Bomb, and I personally couldn't be happier. Audrey handles all things retail, works with our stockists, and is our number-crunching analytics queen. Right, Audrey?
Correct.
I thought it would be fun for everyone to learn a little bit more about Audrey, so we're doing a speed round with her. Ready?
I'm ready.
Are you nervous?
Yeah.
This is your official Radio Cherry Bomb debut, right, for the most part?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll leave it at that. Which city is the superior culinary destination, Sydney or Melbourne?
Melbourne.
Which city are you from?
I'm from Melbourne, and I love food because I grew up there.
What did you study in college?
I studied business.
Besides me, who is your favorite podcast host?
Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway.
Of course. Mine too these days. One food you would never eat.
Oh, I hate liver. Never.
Really?
Eat liver.
Mm-hmm. Never eaten liver.
I've eaten it, but I never again will.
I love liver. Ooh. All right. Food you miss from Australia.
It's a little cliche, but I do get like meat pie cravings sometimes. Yeah.
Okay. Tell us what a meat pie is, because I really am not entirely sure.
It's basically just a beef stew and then cooked in pastry, but okay. It's like a fun, like, weekend lunch or like easy treat, bakery treat. Yeah.
Is it something you would make at home?
Not really, unless you were really into cooking. Like, okay. It's so easy to buy.
Okay. A song that makes you smile.
Taylor Swift's new album just came out. I Forgot That You Existed is really fun.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. I forgot to mention you are our resident Taylor Swift fan. So Taylor Swift, if you're listening and you want to be on the cover of Cherry Bomb.
Also, if you want to just hang out.
All right. Tell us what a flat white is.
Oh, a flat white is a coffee that I believe is from Melbourne. And it's basically like all the good things in the world. It's basically just a shot of espresso and then the heated up milk, but no froth.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. Have you ever worked as a barista?
I worked at a movie theater and I had to make coffees as part of that.
Oh, now you tell me that.
Yeah. But I was bad, but I don't think you expect a good coffee at a movie theater. So I was like, it's fine.
That is 100% correct. Restaurant you would love to eat at one day. It has to be a female chef or forget it.
I want to go to Missy. I've never been.
You've never been? Mm-hmm. We can arrange that. Missy, Chef Missy Robbins, Missy. If you had to be trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be and why?
Maggie Beer. She is the grandmother of Australia, I think. And I used to watch her shows after school and it's just comforting. And I think it would be a very fun time.
The grandmother of Australia or the grandmother of Australia cooking?
Cooking. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about her. I don't know about her.
She has a pheasant farm in the Barossa Valley and she makes all these great products and she is going to be the new MasterChef Australia host. And she's very into home cooking. She's very famous for using verjuice and everything.
Verjuice. Okay. Mm. I have never cooked with verjuice. Would she make you meat pies on that beach?
Oh, definitely.
Definitely. Okay. That sounds good. You Australians have so much hometown pride for MasterChef Australia.
I think that show has changed the way that my generation views food because it's on 5 nights a week. And at its peak, it got higher ratings than a lot of like sports finals. So it's like a huge thing. And they talk about, you know, everyone's food dream. And I think have done a lot to educate people on how to cook better food at home.
Wow, 5 nights a week?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and some of the episodes will be half of it is the competition and then the other half is the masterclass. So it's 3 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
And it's launched so many careers.
Has it ever made you cry?
Yes.
Huh.
It's okay. Very emotional.
So since you said a lot about their food dreams, what's your food dream, Audrey Payne? And then we'll let you go.
My food dream is to have a cafe.
It is? Yeah. I haven't abused you of that notion.
No. I was like, I can't tell Carrie because she'll be like, you're crazy.
Well, no, you can run the Cherry Bomb Cafe.
Yeah, that's the food dream.
Which you're all hearing for the first time is something we are working on. So if you listen all the way to the end of the show, you just got a little news nugget there, people. And now we have something else to add to Audrey's job description. Mm-hmm. All right, Audrey, you're the bomb.
You're the bomb.
That's it for today's show. Jordana Rothman, thanks for filling in for me. And Elena Reagan, thanks for coming by Radio Cherry Bomb. Be sure to check out Elena's memoir, Burn the Place, and then make plans to visit Elizabeth or Milkweed Inn. Elena's interview was recorded at The Wing in Dumbo. Thanks to the Wing women, as always. And thank you to today's sponsors, Traeger Wood-Fired Grills and Le Cordon Bleu Culinary Schools. Don't forget, we'd love if you could support the Hunger Doesn't Take a Break initiative from the Food Bank for New York City. Visit foodbanknyc.org for more. Radio Cherry Bomb is a production of Cherry Bomb Media. Our show is edited, engineered, and produced by Jess Seidman. Cherry Bomb is powered by Lauren Page Goldstein, Audrey Payne, Kia Damone, and Donna Yen. Our publisher is the one and only Kate Miller Spencer. And our theme song is All Fired Up by the band Tra La La. Are you all fired up? I know I am. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Hi, my name is Susanna Raffield, and I'm the owner of Camp Craft Cocktails. Do you want to know who I think is the bomb? Sana Haveri Kadri, owner of Diaspora Co-op, a food business that sells single-origin turmeric from India. Sana is the bomb because she works directly with Indian farmers, ensuring pay equity and a quality product while disrupting and decolonizing food systems. When she's not in Mumbai, Sana lives in Oakland, California, with her pit bull, Lily, and partner in life, Rosie.